Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Adolescent delinquency, coming in the form of criminal activity, violence, and/or the abuse of controlled substances, is considered a serious problem in the United States and many countries around the world. Many problems that begin in the teenage years continue into adulthood, oftentimes leading to more deleterious consequences for those individuals, their friends and families, and society as a whole. Policymakers who seek to reduce the harmful effects of delinquency frequently turn to social scientists to help them understand the causes of such behavioral problems as a way of developing programs to stem the tide of delinquency early in the life cycle. What role does religion, both in terms of belief and practice, play in preventing adolescent delinquency? Can scientific findings that show a connection between religiosity and a decrease in destructive teen behavior inform some of our policy choices as a nation? To address these questions, I am joined by Byron Johnson, co-founder and director of Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the director of Baylor's Program on Pro-Social Behavior, and a noted expert on religion, delinquency, and criminology. In fact, Byron holds numerous distinguished chairs, I think enough distinguished chairs that you could fill an auditorium with. So he's a well-known scholar here. And he is also the author of a number of academic articles and policy reports and has served on advisory committees for two presidential administrations. Professor Johnson's currently working on a book project entitled More God, Less Crimes, How Religion and Faith-Based Programs Reduce Crime and Foster Hope. Byron, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's good to be here.
I have a question about the title of that book, More God, Less Crime, that you're working on. Is that a nod to John Lott's More Guns, Less Crime book?
Yes, yes. I kind of stole that from him. I love that title from his book, and so we thought we'd incorporate it in this one.
Well, it's a great title, because what I have found out is that a lot of academics and scholars who study delinquency, who study criminology and that, don't give a lot of credit either to gun laws that allow people for concealed carry weapons, that was the point of John Lott's book, or interestingly, they don't give very much credence to whether religion can actually affect delinquency, crime, and the such.
This is so true, Tony. It's really unfortunate. You know, back in the Paleolithic era, when I was in graduate school, there was next to no research on the role of religion and the influence it may or may not have on crime and delinquency. And it always kind of surprised me that there was so little scholarship on the subject. And I knew that that would be one of the things that I would want to concentrate on in my career. And I remember my major professor in graduate school said to me, you know, but Byron, I think that's a dead end. I just don't think there's a whole lot there to go on, and I don't think you can make much of a career out of doing research on God and crime, and so needless to say, I've made a pretty good career at it, and I think he's just like so many academics.
Right.
They don't think about religion. They don't happen to be religious themselves, and so they would say they're not biased against religion. They just think it's completely irrelevant. And, of course, they don't see that as a bias at all. And so, thankfully, that's beginning to change, and there has been a literature that's developed. And so we now know quite a bit about the way religion impacts society.
I think that's pretty surprising that many scholars consider it to be irrelevant. It's a similar sentiment that Jeff Levin, in an earlier podcast that we had here on Research on Religion, had as well. I said, oh, no, religion and prayer, none of that can affect your health at all. And same thing here with adolescent delinquency. It seems to me that you know, what scholars ignore or don't know is fairly commonly known amongst the population as a whole. I mean, parents, after they have kids, there's a desire to return to church. And the reason is put their kids in Sunday school so that they get a good moral foundation. They don't grow up to be, thugs or ne'er-do-wells or scalawags or anything of that nature. So it seems that, you know, the population as a whole knows that. But as you say, academics don't have much contact with it. If they don't have much contact with it, it just seems to be an irrelevant topic.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of like if my grandma were still alive, she would read the title of this book and think it's not even worth picking up and reading. I mean, of course,
right.
More God, less crime. But to our colleagues, it'll be more than a little intriguing, to say the least.
Well, before we talk about the relationship between religion and delinquency, let's talk about it from the framework of the secular social scientist, who doesn't really consider that to be an important factor. What are the main theories or ideas that are in the literature on criminology that affect juvenile delinquency?
Well, you know, one of the things that I did when I was exposed to all these secular theories, I would quickly evaluate these theories to see if there was room for religion.
Mm-hmm.
And because religion wasn't really taught in graduate school. And so, for example, one of the theories, control theory, that I kind of gravitated to because it said basically, maybe we look at this whole thing of delinquency in the wrong way. Instead of asking, you know, why do kids commit illegal acts, maybe we should be asking the question, why is it that so many kids don't?
Right.
Why is it that the vast majority of kids stay out of trouble?
Mm-hmm.
Even kids that come from neighborhoods or with risk factors that would kind of predispose them to commit crime, most of them don't.
Right.
Why is that? And, of course, the theory basically says that, you know, for a lot of people, they have these commitments, they have these attachments in their lives, they have the influence of people around them. They have too much to lose by actually doing something that's against the law. And I thought, well, that makes sense to me. And, you know, one of the things that you could easily fold into a theory like that is because faith in their lives may be one of the things that keeps them from breaking the law. Although when I read the theory, there was never any reference to religion.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing for other theories that you might study as a social scientist. And there are so many of them. Strain theory is one that we've tested a lot where, you know, people they have these strains in their lives. They want things. They want materialistic kinds of objectives. They want money and, there's this conflict between what's the right thing to do and how do you achieve these goals, and are there some illegitimate ways that you can do this and still achieve the goal? But there are so many more theories, Tony, out there that
mm-hmm.
now we're beginning to go back and reanalyze these theories, and one of them is like life course theory,
mm-hmm.
that there are events in your life that may change your whole outlook and how you behave. And, you know, social scientists, we like jargon, and so, you know, we call these trajectories and turning points. But for everyday people, it would be like you said earlier, marriage is a turning point in your life.
Right.
Having children is a turning point in your life, and getting a job is a turning point in your life. And if these things don't work out for you, it may take your trajectory and throw it into a tailspin. But people who do this work don't typically think of religion as a turning point or a potential turning point.
Mm-hmm.
What about conversion?
Right.
And, you know, spiritual transformations, could these not be viewed as turning points? So every time you look at a theory, be it learning theory or social disorganization theory, you look at all these theories, and once you think about them, religion is such an easy kind of a variable to not only throw into an equation, but to give you new insights for why we might expect, certain kinds of outcomes.
Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and explore that then in terms of religion and in term and connection with some of these theories, as well as you mentioned, these theories, you know, may have some theoretical weight or some explanatory weight to them, but they're missing that background information of religion, religious experience.
Right.
Before going further, let's define what we're talking about here, what we mean by religion and what we mean by adolescent delinquency. So when you engage in your studies, how do you define religion? You
right.
mentioned putting it in as a variable. I
right.
don't know if there's just a variable called religion, or how do you measure
you
that?
You know, here's one of the intriguing things that I hope your reviewers will understand is so frustrating. For people like you and me, we get our hands on these data sets where people have gone before us and collected fantastic data. Sometimes this data is even longitudinal, where we track people from their youth all the way through adulthood, and we can see what happens to them as kids, as teenagers, as young adults. These studies are hard to do because they take so much time.
Right.
And then there are other studies where we have cross-sectional data, where it's a slice of the American public, and you look at one time point. These are all great data sets to analyze and to test theories, but so many of them have not included religion at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like it's very difficult for people like myself. Sometimes you want to study religion, and then you look at this data set, and they don't even have the first question. So
right.
there again, you're confronted with what I would say, you know, at best is an oversight, and at worst, it's just outright discrimination and hostility mm-hmm. toward religion that we don't even have measures that we can begin to analyze. But in some of these data sets, they do ask questions, and they typically tend to ask questions like, do you believe in God, or how often do you attend religious services?
Mm-hmm.
And this attendance variable tends to be the basic core variable that scholars tend to ask about, and then in some other data sets, they'll ask questions about how important is your faith. How important is God in your life? Questions that would basically get at some kind of self-reported indicator of how important faith is to you in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we call that self-reported or religious salience. And those are the two main ways in which we ask about religion. And some of your listeners may be saying, well, that's totally inappropriate. There's so many more questions you could be asking me.
Right.
And, I know a friend of my, a mutual friend of ours, Rodney Stark, was telling me about a survey he did in the 60s when he asked this question: do you pray about, you know, material possessions,
mm-hmm.
something like that? And the person put, yes, I strongly agree with this question. And then in the margin, she put in, this is how I furnished my whole house, indicating that she prayed about everything.
Wow, yeah.
And so, at any rate, most of our surveys don't give people the chance to respond in maybe the ways that they would like to respond about how important religion is in their life. And we're kind of limited. But I can say that the data that I look at most often ask people about their religious attendance, and I would say it's a good measure. It's
right.
limited. Certainly we can do so much better. But that's the main way in which we measure religious commitment. And in some of these studies where they ask questions about how often do you attend, how often do you practice, and how important is it in your life, we take that, we combine these variables and make like an index.
Mm-hmm.
So we call them a multidimensional measure. And that has helped a bit as well in doing the research. But there's really a lot of progress that we need to make in how we study religion and the spiritual life that so many people have.
Right, I know that's unfortunate with a number of studies and academics not knowing what constitutes religion is a limiting factor as well. The attendance factor, and I hope to return to this a little bit later in our conversation, is interesting because it's, and many people have critiqued the attendance variable as only a partial proxy for religiosity, because there might be a number of people, especially when we're talking here teenagers, that, as the Bellamy brothers would say, got drugged to church. They were there against their own free will and might not be all that religious, but because grandma is going, you're going to go as well.
You know, Tony, it's a valid concern that, you know, yeah, I went to church. I didn't enjoy church. My parents took me there kind of against my will. But, the data really, I think, offers some different insights to that.
Mm-hmm.
What we find over and over again is that church attendance matters, and mm-hmm. it matters for young and old alike. And, you know, in one of the studies that we did, and I don't want to get too jargony here, but we looked at religion in youth over time.
Mm-hmm.
And the more kids stayed in church through their adolescent period, the more likely they were to receive an accumulated benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, you know, if you were raised in poverty, you could say there are all these disadvantages.
Right.
That people have to deal with. We found that religion makes you advantaged
mm-hmm.
in that you have an advantage over other people if you don't fall away from the faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you've indicated correctly, there are a lot of kids, you know, when they get into their early teens, they don't come to church anymore.
Right.
They later get married, and they come back to church because they want to raise their kids in church. But what we find is for those that never left the church, there's this added benefit that inoculates them, if you will, from all kinds of problems of behavior. So there's this added benefit if they stay in there. And I think that's really critical. And then one of the things that I was going to say is that, you know, we find that religion has its own unique effect.
Mm-hmm.
And for social scientists, this is a big deal because there are times when people say, yeah, religion's important, and the reason why it's important is it's actually measuring these other things.
Mm-hmm.
It's not religion. It's education, or, you know, it's income, or it may be that this person just has a lot of self-control.
Right.
It's not religion. And so the better the study you do, the more you're able to control for the effects of this and that. And one of the more exciting things I think that we've been able to do in the last 3 to 5 years is to do some pretty sophisticated studies that says controlling for all that we can control for, religion is a powerful inhibitor. It really does help people stay out of trouble, especially kids, such that religion has its own unique effects.
Let's go ahead and talk about that a little bit more.
Well, I mean, it's really important because you mm-hmm. can't basically wash it out.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who try to explain it away. I've tried to explain away religion.
Mm-hmm.
But you just can't seem to do it. So, yes, it has these indirect effects, and those are important, but there are these direct effects that we can only explain, it appears, that religion itself has some kind of a powerful hold on people. And, you know, we need to do more research to understand that. Could it be that there are these networks of support
right.
that young people experience in a congregation, and that those networks of support are what become so meaningful? It's not necessarily a sermon that they hear on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
but it's these other people that come around them, and the whole issue of, you know, mentoring. But nonetheless, we're now beginning to isolate. And I think once you begin to do that, that really opens up the door for how we might be thinking about religion in other ways.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of delinquency, you're talking here about these networks of support, that you're talking youth groups, right?
Right.
And, you know, possibly stronger connections with the family. How does this work to affect? Now, you've done some study on drugs. Youth taking drugs as well as violent behavior. We put that in the context of one of your specific studies and say, how does this social network actually play out in reducing drug use among teens?
I've got two studies that I think that I hope that the people hearing this show will appreciate that shows just that. We looked at drug use and alcohol abuse as well among teens. In one study, what we did was we compared inner-city minority children raised in poverty tracts.
Mm-hmm.
So you could imagine these are kids that typically are kids of color that come from underprivileged backgrounds. They live largely in housing projects. and they largely tend to be African American. Mm-hmm. And when you put those factors together, poverty, disadvantage, it usually can spell trouble. But what we found was that inner city kids who go to church, who are in poverty, are less likely to use drugs and alcohol than our white suburban kids who come from middle class families who don't go to church.
That result is completely astounding.
Yeah, it is completely counterintuitive.
Right.
So, you know, our colleagues in the field kind of scratch their head on a finding like that, because it's not at all what our theories would tell us we should expect to find. And what we say is that, you know, could it be that the church itself is an agency of social control, that the church exhibits these strong influences over these kids? Because otherwise, you would expect them to, be abusing drugs or alcohol. And, you know, we find this is also true in, you know, the selling of drugs.
Right.
And other illegal behaviors. So we did another study where we looked at kids. We looked at black males, young black males from Chicago, Boston, and Philadelphia, and the requirement was they had to be living in poverty tracts, housing projects. And what we found was, and so the end size was enormous, if you attended church regularly, you were much less likely to be involved in drug use, illegal activities, the selling of drugs. You were more likely to stay in school, more likely to make better grades. And so what basically we concluded was escaping the poverty of the ghetto was a real possibility if you could attend church. It was the only thing that seemed to separate those two groups.
Right.
And so I think that here again is what we're finding is that even in the midst of all this disadvantage, a lot of these kids make it. And how do they make it? And previously scholars haven't been able to address that very well. And I think it's because they've overlooked the potential for religion to have that kind of an effect on young people.
Well, let me play devil's advocate on this study a little bit. And if I was a scholar who didn't think that religion was all that important, I would say to you, well, you know, Byron, that's interesting. You picked up this church attendance effect. But, you know, it really what it is that the reason they're going to church is because their parents, they live in a two-parent household, and their parents are much more concerned about observing their behavior. So it's really the parental observation of their behavior that is motivating things rather than the church itself. How would you respond to something like that?
Well, there's some truth there. We know that kids that come from intact families tend to outperform other kids. We know that to be true. However, in this one study that I just referred to, looking at kids, young black males growing up in Chicago, Boston, and Philadelphia in poverty, what we found is that coming from a single-family household did not predispose them to criminal activity if they were involved in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And what this, you know, how I interpret that is to say, okay, perhaps the church becomes a parent by default for so many of these kids who maybe come from a house where they're being raised by one parent, and maybe a family member, like a grandparent. But here again is where I think the church plays an enormous role that they're often not given credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in particular the black church in America gets very little credit for the role that it is playing in our inner cities. I mean, I have to tell you that if it weren't for the African-American church in our inner cities, it would be a much, much different place. And I'm referring to communities all across the country. So we have so many black congregations and I think black clergy to be thankful to for all the good work that they do.
Right, right. I mean, you bring up the black churches, and a lot of these tend to be evangelical churches, Baptist, Southern Baptist, number of Methodist churches. Is there a denominational effect that you've observed? Is it possible that evangelical religions are much better at stemming drug use and violence than, say, a Presbyterian or Unitarian or Catholic churches?
That is a really, it's a very good question, and a little complicated. I would say in general that the denominational effects, they exist in some studies and they don't in others. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say they don't exist in others is because they seem to be trumped by the attendance variable.
I see.
So let's just say you're raised in an Episcopal church,
mm-hmm.
what you and I would call a mainline church,
mm-hmm.
and probably not, and it would not fit into the category of an evangelical church. But if you attend that church and you regularly attend that church and you are a person that's deeply committed in your faith, the more likely thing is that the church attendance itself is going to be a variable that is prominent in the analysis, versus a kid who goes to a Baptist church and doesn't attend, and a kid that goes to an Episcopal church and does attend.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the attendance variable appears to be more important, but we do have studies that show being raised in, for example, an evangelical congregation or evangelical affiliation does seem to help in some cases deter young people from certain kinds of activities that maybe are not highlighted as much in a church that doesn't put as much emphasis on certain kinds of behavior.
Right.
So I think there are these denominational effects, but the bigger effect really does appear to be this whole commitment variable.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you had the opportunity to also explore the depth of a person's spiritual belief, and does that have an independent effect from attendance? 'Cause I can see attendance, if you get kids into a social network, a youth group, you start to develop, they have friends that are not using drugs. It creates a strong group that allows them to resist peer pressure from others. But is there something other than attendance in that, people with deep sense belief have a moral compass, so to speak, that
right.
prevents them from engaging in delinquent behavior?
Well, I think the answer to that is that we need more research to help us, because so many of the data sets don't do a good job of tapping into these small groups that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of Rick Warren's congregation, where they have like 3,000 small groups.
Right.
And some of these mega churches that you see, and you're wondering, how does that work to have a congregation that size? Well, the reality is they have all these small groups
mm-hmm.
that are very intimate, where people do get to know each other, and they do develop these strong ties, but we know very little about them. And I think once we get to know more about them, we're going to find what you just alluded to, and that there's something very special going on there.
Right.
And that's how come, apparently, we did a survey here at Baylor, and it shows that these mega churches are the most friendly churches you can go to.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems to be a little counterintuitive, because you'd think they'd be cold and you'd be anonymous. No one would know your name.
Right.
But in fact, they go out of their way to get you plugged in
mm-hmm.
so that you're not anonymous, and that people can be engaged in your life, and that people can have an influence on you. And I think these things are really, really important. But we just don't have a lot of great data to help us understand how some of these things are actually happening. And it's an oversight. That's why I think there's just such a crying need for research on congregations
right.
and on how congregations function and on how people do or don't get plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that once we do that, I think this is going to open up a whole bunch of doors for us to pursue about how we can measure the depth of these commitments in ways that I just don't think we've done just yet.
And that's a really good point. One of the points of research on religion here is not just necessarily to give answers to questions, but also to talk about avenues for future research. And there might be some graduate student out there listening, and I think we just put down a dissertation topic in somebody's lap.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, one of the neat things, and I've read a number of your papers on this, when you talk about the data that you do have, and this is relative to us political scientists, we have some limitations here, but you have what you called longitudinal data, or sometimes called panel studies, where you follow people over time. Every other year they're resurveyed, or every 5 years, or every 10 years, which is enormously beneficial because you can track these same people over time rather than relying upon a cross-section and making certain assumptions that, well, these people were pretty much the same as people 10 years ago. So let's explore that longitudinal aspect a little bit. In your studies that use this longitudinal data, does it matter in terms of the juvenile delinquency effect, whether a kid starts early in church and goes a long time, or maybe he starts when he's 10 or 12 and starts going to church? Or is there also effect that, well, the kid went to church from, you know, being 5 years old to 12 years old, stopped going? Does that religious effect go away, or is there still some residual effect that would keep him from delinquent behavior?
I think that what we're finding is that, you know, for a lot of kids, there is this tendency in the teen years to pull away from church.
Mm-hmm.
A lot don't, but a significant number of people do. And I think there's a real misinformation out there. I think there's a lot of unnecessary claims made by people with good intentions within the Christian community that basically contend that, you know, kids these days don't go to church anymore. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we're very close to having a generation of kids that are godless.
Right.
There's absolutely no evidence to support that, but yet you hear this all the time, and you hear it from pulpits too, and it's bad science.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a manipulation of the data, and I think sometimes it's done to kind of cause a panic.
Right.
We do see some falling off of attendance, but as you alluded to, a lot of these people come back, and the reason why they come back is because these early childhood experiences they've not forgotten.
Right.
They've not left the faith. They've done some exploring, they've done some questioning, and the vast majority of them do come back and start attending. So, yes, there is this effect that doesn't seem to go away for a lot of them, and I think that the longitudinal data helps us understand that. Once again, though, the problem with some of the longitudinal data is because religion is included in one wave but maybe not the next, because...
Right.
Scholars haven't thought it was important enough to include in every time. So instead of interviewing a person once every 2 or 3 years, as you might ordinarily do, religion is in wave one, and then it's in wave four, and it's in wave eight, and you'd think, why couldn't religion be in every wave of data?
Right.
That would be very helpful to us. But here again, we've seen it not included in some of the key data sets that we look at when we're studying crime and delinquency. And so that also hampers us from getting a better picture of what may be happening.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't think there's any question. And now even most scholars in criminology are admitting, wow, this is an important variable.
Right.
As much as they hate to admit it, I think they're beginning to understand that there's a lot going on here that they can't. That religion's a very robust variable, as we would say.
All right. And in terms of talking just a little inside baseball here in terms of academics, one of the reasons that these variables tend to get excluded is that you have an ongoing study and people get research grants that, you know, they get a research grant and in the second wave they say, oh, I'd like to include X, Y, and Z questions. And invariably that has to bump some other questions out.
Exactly.
So that always can be a problem. So, you know, consistent funding for this research should be a high priority for folks who are interested in discovering these effects as well.
Yeah.
But even when you do have instances where you're losing some of that data, do you notice that kids who go to church early in their lives but then drop out, maybe not going their teen years, are they less likely to be involved in drug use?
They really are. There is this protective factor that religion provides for these kids. I mean, one of the studies that we just completed, we have under review right now. This is social science jargon, but we look at initiation. When do people experiment with drugs?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so some of these people We look at desistance. What is it that makes people quit using them? And then persistence. Why is it that some people experiment with drugs and get hooked on drugs and they use drugs for a long time? So it's these three categories that a lot of criminologists are interested in: initiation, persistence, and desistance. And what we found is, for young people that have this early attendance, they're significantly less likely to even initiate drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very significant finding, that because if you could do anything, you'd want to prevent it from the very outset.
Right.
We didn't find the desistance variable to be affected very much by religion, and the reason why is the religion had already done its work at the entry level.
It's like a vaccine.
It really is like a vaccine. And so one of the beautiful things about religion that I've been trying to bring some attention to is it protects, it keeps people from getting into trouble, but it also protects from harm, but then it promotes good.
Right.
And by that I mean pro-social. And that's why one of the things that we're doing here that you and I have talked about in the past is looking at pro-social studies. Mm-hmm. Instead of just looking at antisocial behavior, you know, why is it that kids do bad things? Why is it that the vast majority of them do good things? And we spend next to no time looking at that part of the equation.
And that's a great, you know, tool in social sciences, that we get so used to examining one question: why is there why is there deviant behavior? But you flip that question around and you say, well, why isn't there more deviant behavior? And you get entirely new perspective on the question. And again, this brings up the religion variable.
It does. And why is it that people do volunteer work?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that people give to charities, both religious and non-religious? In fact, we know from the literature now pretty convincingly that people of faith not only outgive to religious charities, their secular counterparts, they outgive to secular charities as well. Mm-hmm. than their secular counterparts. These are people that give. And when you ask them why, faith is a driving force for people. You know, their faith motivated to do these things. It's just like mentoring.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why do people do mentoring? Well, we know mentoring matters, first of all,
right.
And a lot of people do it because they're motivated out of faith to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they do so many other volunteer work as well.
And it's interesting how it's not just the kid that's involved in this, but there are the community of people around them that become very important. And as you say, you know, getting people to mentor a child in a church becomes enormously important for that kid at a certain given time.
You know, Tony, as you mentioned, I'm writing this book. I'm almost done with it on More God, Less Crime. And one of the things that I highlight in the book are two stories. One is the Boston Miracle,
mm-hmm.
where in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the gang violence in Boston was so pervasive. The community was so troubled by the number of kids that were being killed, and it kind of culminated in 1992 when a kid who was killed in a drive-by shooting by a gang, at his funeral, another youth was fleeing gang members and fled into the church.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get away from these gang members, they went into the church, stabbed, shot. So you have a shootout in a church at a funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, it was like, that was enough. The churches got together and they decided, we can do something about this crime problem. And they did. And they started working with the police in a unique partnership. You know, the police and preachers get together, and what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And they started an effort that's still in existence today, and they drove the crime rate and the violence rate down so far that it became known as the Boston Miracle, and other cities started trying to copy what they were doing. And this just shows you, this is one example of what a few congregations can do when they get really serious about something like, in this case, gang activity. And so it's a remarkable story of the power of faith in the lives of these congregations to change whole communities. And then another story that I tell in the book is about mentoring children of prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of million kids right now in the U.S. who have a parent locked up. Well, what's happening to these kids? These are kids that very likely, if not attended to, are going to wind up in prison themselves. And so there's been an effort, a movement that was started in 2000 to use congregations to provide mentors for these kids. And this particular program was called Amachi, and now it's spread. It's all over the country, and it's an excellent example of how people are living out their faith, working with these at-risk kids to give a mentor in their life to keep them from winding up in the place where one of their parents has been.
Well, let me ask you about that, because that's an interesting question. We talked about how religion can inoculate a child early on from bad influences, you know, be it in terms of creating a better community surrounding where they can resist peer pressure, just, you know, providing a moral compass for them, saying this is
sure.
wrong. But what about kids who, as you mentioned, are at risk? They, you know, 13, 14 years old, they've had bad experiences, they haven't been going to church, one of their parents might be in prison, they come from a broken home.
Right.
Is there evidence that if you get this kid into a religious group, that can really alter their life course and put it on a different path?
There's preliminary evidence that would indicate that's true.
Mm-hmm.
We know from a major study done at Public-Private Ventures in Philadelphia, where they study big brothers and big sisters in a randomized design, that kids who had the benefit of a mentor were much more likely to fare better on a series of outcomes. You know, it really did help these kids. Now, these were not children of prisoners.
Right.
And so the story that I'm telling in the book of this Amachi story has yet to answer that question
mm-hmm.
that you ask. But, you know, only time will tell what the answer looks like. My sense is that we'll see much the same as we saw in the earlier PPV research of Big Brothers and Big Sisters,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, having a caring adult to come into a child's life can be incredibly important. It goes back to what we had talked about at the outset of this interview, and that is it could be a turning point.
Right.
You know, so these mentors come into the life of the kid, and these kids are facing so many obstacles. I mean, they live in neighborhoods where violence is everywhere, drug dealing is everywhere, and there are these enormous temptations that they have to deal with. And this is where one person in your life could make a profound
mm-hmm.
Difference. I mean, when we were in Philadelphia before moving to Texas, my wife participated in this very program that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the girl that she mentored, who's now 17, calls her all the time.
Wow. Yeah.
They're still in touch.
Yeah.
And we moved 6 years ago. So I think that just having one person in your life can be important. And I do think it's important that it's more than 1 hour a week, which is
right.
the way that the pitch is normally made. Would you give 1 hour a week to a child like this?
Yeah.
I don't think that you can do a whole lot in 1 hour a week. I think it requires more of an investment than that. But we really don't have sufficient evidence right now to say that it'll change these lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm confident that once we are able to do that work, that we're going to find just that.
You mentioned that your wife was mentoring a young woman, and I'm wondering to what effect or to what extent have you seen any type of gender effect in here? Is religion really more effective for women? Is it more effective for boys?
Yeah.
Is there anything that the data shows?
You know, Tony, that's another fascinating question. I think the best way to answer that is that there is a gender effect that religion consistently in studies here in the U.S. and all across the world shows that women tend to be more devout than men.
Right.
And it just doesn't seem to matter where you look, you find these effects. Does this mean that religion isn't important for men? Not at all. I mean, we found in a number of our studies looking at males that religion was profoundly important for men.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently it's more important for women consistently than it is for men, and I don't have a good answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
We also find that for African Americans, there is an effect that religion tends to be even more important for African Americans than for whites.
Mm, that's interesting.
And that's a pretty consistent finding, too.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, I'm thinking about the difference between, you know, girls and boys when it comes to delinquency. There tends to be different types of delinquency or social problems involved. For men, it's probably going to be more violence than women.
Yes.
You know, at the margin, it's not to say that women aren't violent at all at times. But there are, I think, different issues at play here. For women, what about the role of sexual promiscuity? Does religious programs tend to, you know, prevent sexual promiscuity? Because we know one of the big problems, you know, in a number of impoverished communities is single-parent households, which once
right.
you become a single parent and you are pregnant, you tend to stay in poverty for a long time. Is there
right.
any kind of effect that religion plays in
yes.
the role of that?
You know, it's there, and it's in exactly the direction that you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
Young people for whom religion is important, i.e., they attend church regularly, or they say religion's important in their lives, they're much less likely to be sexually promiscuous.
Mm-hmm.
This has been shown in study after study. And, you know, I published a piece back in 2002 where I reviewed the literature, and I looked at things like sexual promiscuity, I looked at delinquency, I looked at drug abuse, alcohol abuse, depression.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at longevity, how long people live, suicidal thoughts that people have. And what you find is when you look at those literatures, and when I say literatures, so let's just say there's 80 studies that look at suicide.
Right.
And there's 100 studies that look at depression. The effects for religion are astounding.
Mm-hmm.
Across these studies, and these are studies done by, you know, psychologists, political scientists, sociologists, you know, anthropologists. These are coming from all different disciplines, and even studies that look at health, physical health,
right.
mental health, they all consistently find that religion is a variable that works in a way that you would expect if you think that religion's important, and
right.
it appears to be important in the vast majority of these studies, and sexual promiscuity would just be one area.
And the reason I bring that up, because there's a debate within academia and I think the public at large about abstinence programs, sexual abstinence programs, and many secular social scientists, psychologists say, well, you know, the kids are going to be kids, and that, you know, just telling them to just say no really isn't all that effective. Is that what the data is showing?
Well, I've read a couple of these studies on abstinence, and I don't know that we have enough data to say how this all plays out. I have read one key study that showed that there is this effect
mm-hmm.
of these abstinence programs, that they do, in fact, delay the onset of sexual activity considerably. I know there's another study out that really kind of questions those findings.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, you know, we're going to need more than a handful of studies to help us understand how these programs may be effective or may not be effective. I mean, on the face of them, it's hard for me to believe that an abstinence program is a bad thing.
Right.
But I do know that For many people, it raises red flags, and I think that's unfortunately a result. They associate religion automatically with these abstinence programs,
mm-hmm.
and because there seems to be this inherent bias against religion among so many within the academy, that these studies just raise red flags for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's unfortunate. We really do need some good research here to help us understand what are the factors that help kids make good choices.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you had mentioned, your 2002 study, is that you did a, I guess what you call a meta-analysis, where you look at, you know, 60, 70, 100 different studies and see what the effect is. I've read a number of your papers that way, and that's really an interesting thing in academia now, to pool a lot of these studies together to see what effects are actually occurring. Because a lot of times when we work in our own individual cubbyhole. We don't see a lot of other studies going on. And so, I think what we'll do is we'll link to that piece for people who want to get a good survey of this, and we'll link to a number of your other articles here as well.
I think that's so good because you're right. We kind of have blinders on,
right.
You know, and sometimes we know a lot, but our area of expertise is so limited.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get this bigger picture and you find that, you know, okay, I've just reviewed 800 studies, and about 85% of them find that religion is associated with beneficial outcomes. And then there's like 1% of the studies that find that religion is associated with some kind of harm.
Right.
The rest of them, the remaining 14%, they don't find any significant findings or, you know, mixed evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a rare study that shows any kind of harmful impact associated with religion. And I was thinking about this the other day. You know, what if we were to find the opposite?
Right.
What if we were to find that 85% of studies show that kids are more inclined to be sexually promiscuous, they're more inclined to use drugs and alcohol, and more likely to use violence as a result of being associated with religion?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what would be the outpouring?
Right.
I think this literature that's largely neglected or overlooked at this point would soon be, you know, a cover story for every major publication.
Right, right. It's interesting. Jeff Levin has done the same thing by surveying a number of different medical studies on religion and health, and
mm-hmm.
you know, what he had mentioned too, and I think you're finding the same thing, is that, you know, you read one, you know, a secular academic who doesn't think religion has much to do with it might come across a study, and the religion variable shows some statistical significance and has some positive role to play in reducing delinquency, but they look at that and they said, you know, that's just a minor result, and they brush that aside and focus on all the other variables.
Yeah.
But you know, if you start to see this in 70 studies, in 80 studies, in 100 studies, just as Jeff did with the relationship between religion and health, you got to stop and pause and say, hey, maybe there is something here, and this little variable that we brush off or has seen to be a control variable that we put into a study, maybe this should be our center of focus now.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, one of the things that I keep calling for is that the federal government and these agencies that sponsor so many studies would begin to put religion on the radar screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for so many of us, the majority of the work that we do on religion, we either just do it in our own time or we have to get a foundation to fund our work.
Right.
It's rare that you get a grant from the federal government to study religion.
Yeah, let's explore that in the remaining time that we have
Sure.
here, in terms of the policy implications and also the grant getting applications here. As you know, I've had numerous grant proposals sent into the National Science Foundation. Whenever you put the religion variable in, they say, "Oh, I don't know if we can do that. We're a federal agency, and the church state separation here always comes into play." In terms of looking at your research, and we're finding that religion does play a huge role in reducing crime, in reducing drug abuse, and possibly reducing sexual promiscuity. What kind of policy implications could come from this? And, you know, to what extent could these things actually get implemented in an environment today where there's this desire to separate church and state so much?
Well, these are really important questions that you've brought up, and I won't say that they're easily solved. There's some legitimate church-state questions that are valid. So, for example, if you look at Teen Challenge, Teen
Right.
Challenge is the world's largest faith-based drug treatment program. I visited their programs in a number of different locations. I think they do incredible work. So they have, you know, you've heard of the 12-step program. Well, they have their own 12-step program. It's not altogether different than traditional AA 12-step, except the first step of the Teen Challenge program is that you have to become a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
That's step one.
Right.
And you know, you can't hardly get to step two until you do step one. Well, that means if step one is you have to profess faith in Jesus Christ, well, that makes them ineligible for grants. They can't take a grant from the federal government, and
mm-hmm.
they understand that, so they don't apply for them.
Right.
There are so many other groups out there, however, that don't make a profession of faith, even though their program is faith-based, they don't make that a requirement for the program. If their program is designed, let's say, to get you a job or to keep you out of jail. So let's just say it's a faith-based prisoner reentry program where we're trying to get you acclimated back into the community, and the last thing we want you to do is to go back to prison.
Right.
Yes, we're faith-motivated and faith-based. We don't say you have to believe this, and if you don't go to church, you're kicked out of our program. Let's say you don't have that. What are you trying to do? You're trying to help these people not be rearrested, so you're trying to make the recidivism rate go down. That's a civic good.
Right.
And if it's faith-based, but it's a program that's geared toward a civic good, and we have evidence that that's what the program does, why would we discriminate against that program and to say, yeah, but because you have a crucifix on the wall and because Bibles are made readily available to program participants, you can no longer partner with government. I just think that that's a misinterpretation of what we really mean by separation of church and state. And I do think that there are ways in which faith-based organizations can partner with government to do good things that the citizens of our country want, which is we want these people to stay out of jail. We don't want them committing new crimes.
Right.
And I think a lot of these problems are bigger than the government, much bigger than the government, and this will make some people uncomfortable. They're bigger than churches. These people, they need faith in their lives, but they also need a job and they need some transportation.
Right.
And so that's why I'm thinking we need kind of a sacred secular partnership on some of these overwhelming problems that we have. I mean, we've got 700,000 plus offenders coming out of prison every year. So for the next 20 years, that's a pretty daunting statistic.
Right.
And these people are coming out to communities near you and me. And so the question is, the government doesn't have enough programs on the ground for this wave of offenders coming out of prison. So why would we not be open to some kind of collaborative efforts? This is where I think it affects public policy. I think people of faith would respond if asked. And in many cases, when they have been asked, they have responded. But I think we've treated religion almost as if it's toxic.
Right.
When in fact, it appears to be just the opposite.
Yeah, it's very, very useful. I mean, I can see how I know a number of faith-based programs that try to deal with social problems don't necessarily have, you must become Christian first in their mission statement. And so in that regard, they can be seen as helping people become secular. But I think there's a concern on a lot of secularists who see, well, you know, this is just the gateway to making them more religious, and they tend to get spooked away from that type of program, unfortunately.
There's a lot of fear out there in the secular world about proselytizing.
Right.
The word evangelism scares some people half to death. And the reality is, if you look at these faith-based soup kitchens and these homelessness initiatives that are faith-based, they don't say, look, here's a bowl of soup, but you can't have it unless you pray this prayer with me right now.
Right.
This doesn't happen. If it did happen, it would be, you know, featured on 60 Minutes as an expose. It just doesn't happen. They don't make belief a requirement for getting services. And, you know, when I was in Philadelphia, a colleague did a study there showing that at a minimum, faith-based groups were providing $250 million worth of social service delivery that the city of Philadelphia would have had to pony up to pay if it weren't for these faith-based groups.
Right.
You know, you don't hear a lot of complaining about that. So, I mean, in real dollars, these faith-based groups are providing enormous value to society, and that's not readily discussed. And really, this is why we need more economists in this area, because we need economists to help us understand, just in terms of dollars and cents, what the faith factor really means for our country.
I think that is absolutely true, especially in economic times like this, when you know more people need help, and you know city, county, state, and federal budgets are busting at the seams in deficit. That you're relying upon, as George H.W. Bush once said, the 1,000 points of lights that are out there. Many of these lights are religious lights, whether you know Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever.
You know, Tony, the media coverage on Katrina pointed out the poor response of state, local, and federal government. What the media coverage almost completely failed to show was the incredible support of the faith-based community in Katrina. These armies of compassion, to invoke another Bush, George W. Bush, these armies of compassion came out of the woodwork for Katrina, but it was a story that didn't get told very well. And so, you know, I think people would rather complain about the government instead of acknowledging what an outpouring we really did have. And so I think that these groups are there. They do incredible work. They get little notice or little credit for it. And I guess what I would like to see happen is for us to do a much better job of documenting what these faith-based groups are doing in areas like delinquency, but it's so much bigger. And, you know, if we can provide empirical evidence that's objective, that will help, I think, policymakers understand different strategies and new ways of looking at some of our serious social problems.
I think that's absolutely true. And one of the benefits of this podcast series, I hope, is to get that word out. The research that you are doing showing that religion has an enormously positive impact on the lives of youth and preventing them from falling into a life of delinquency is incredibly important. And we wish you the best of luck with your studies. We hope that more of this gets published. And for those of you who are listening and would like to join in the conversation with stories of your own or ask questions, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org, where you can find a number of additional links to papers by Professor Johnson and a number of other podcasts that relate to this program. Byron, thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Oh, my pleasure. I think this is going to be a great series. I really can't wait to hear more of these podcasts from you, Tony. Keep up the great work, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.